The writer Jamie Kirchick has been working on his book about the hidden history of Washington for years. It's called Secret City, and it's about how gay people had such a critical influence on the city, on the power and the policy peddled there. And he says everywhere and nowhere, gay men and lesbians were hiding in plain sight, trying to constantly protect themselves within the institutional order of the Capitol. So the book is about the underground scene and culture of gay Washington, and it's full of stories of people like this one, a Washington fixture, a player, a man named Joe Alsop.
Joe Alsop was something that we don't really have much anymore. He was a very influential newspaper columnist, and he really had an entree to power. He was close friends with the Roosevelts. He wore tortoiseshell glasses. He was a real snob, but he was also a very charming man and a closeted homosexual at a time when that was an extremely dangerous thing to be in Washington. And I should note here that he was also an extremely hawkish Cold Warrior. And in 1957, Joe was visiting Moscow on a reporting trip. He is given the grand tour. He travels the country. He's given an interview with Nikita Khrushchev. And he's out for dinner one evening when a very handsome young Russian man essentially seduces him, brings him back to his hotel room. They engage in sexual activity. He's invited back the next day. And when he shows up, a group of KGB agents burst into the room. They throw down some photographs. They try to pressure Alsop into becoming basically an informant for them back when he returns to Washington. What Alsop actually does is he happens to be friends with the ambassador to the Soviet Union at the time, old Harvard buddies, the man named Charles Bolin. Alsop went immediately to him, told him the situation. Bolin got him out of Moscow on the next flight to Paris, where he was met with some agents from the CIA to be debriefed. And he wrote out an entire confession, not only what happened to him in Moscow with this sexual incident, but also his entire basic sexual history. He admitted that he had been an incurable homosexual since youth, that he had sought treatment for it, but he couldn't change, obviously. He essentially did exactly what the guardians of the national security state in America in this period demanded of a homosexual in this position, to not betray your country and not turn over secrets to the nation's adversaries or enemies, but to come straight to your government and admit everything. It's exactly what he did. This hung over him like a sort of Damocles for the rest of his career. The confession that he wrote for the CIA inevitably found its way into the hands of J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. There were multiple times when officials in the Eisenhower administration, when they would get upset with Alsop over a column he wrote, would threaten that they were going to expose him as a homosexual. And yet, Alsop didn't relent in his writing or his views, his very hawkish Cold War views, and he became one of the loudest voices of support for the Vietnam War. Whatever you think about his views on that, to persist in them in the full knowledge that, you know, at any moment his secret could be exposed, I think did take some courage. And I think a lot of weaker men would have shriveled away from the fight. Alsop never came out, I mean, not publicly. The sense of shame was so overriding. And I was reminded of this when I recently read a couple weeks ago. The New York Times did a piece about Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York. They posthumously outed him. But Ed Koch never came out. And I think it's just important to note this because this was a man who represented probably the most liberal district in the country. He came from Greenwich Village when he was a congressman. That's the district that he represented. This is the actual district where the Stonewall Uprising began. That's where the Stonewall Inn is located. So, you know, if the man who represented the birthplace of gay liberation, himself did not feel comfortable coming out of the closet, then that just tells you how powerful the closet was for men of a certain generation. It's very important that we understand that when we're judging people, or that perhaps that we not judge people who came before us in this way, or that we understand the context in which they lived, in that Ed Koch and Joe Alsop grew up at a time when being gay was illegal, when it was medically pathologized, socially condemned by every institution in society, and it spelled death for a career in politics or national journalism. That was the era in which they grew up in. And the scars that that can create on someone, the shame, the sense of fear that that can create in someone is extremely profound.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jamie Kirchick is joining us today to talk about what he describes as the wide-ranging influence of homosexuality on the nation's capital. He says it's a framework to understand the history of politics in the country during the 20th century, because this obsession with state secrecy often collided with the personal secrets men and women were trying to protect. Kirchick told us there were two parts of this influence you have to understand. He says it was built on secrecy and universality.
Homosexuality was not spoken of. The word is often not used. And in fact, in researching the book, I just came across all these euphemisms that people would use to describe homosexuality, beginning with the Bible, which condemns those at Sodom and Gomorrah who exchange natural relations for unnatural, right? To lie with a man as to lie with a woman. I came across a reverend in 17th century America, early 17th century America, who describes a wickedness not to be named. And then in 1837, the legislature in North Carolina passed a law describing the abominable and detestable crime against nature not to be named among Christians. It was banned from film. You know, homosexuality could not be depicted in film under the code until the 1960s. So this concept is so beyond the pale, it cannot be discussed, right? And so that means that gay people are a secret people. They have to hide. And that makes them very frightening because unlike other minorities, like say African-Americans, gay people can pass, which made them an invisible threat. And so and then what happens is that, you know, the universality aspect, that becomes apparent, say, after World War II. So prior to that period, there's this vague notion of homosexuality. We know what it is. It's condemned in the Bible. It's this horrible, sinful thing. But we've never met one of these people. Like, maybe they're in public parks. They're criminals. They're these sorts of boogeymen. But then what happens in World War II is that you have all these gay people meeting one another for the first time. And it becomes this sort of national coming out moment. And a lot of gay people meet other gay people for the first time. And so it really sort of builds a gay consciousness. And then the decisive factor is the 1948 Kinsey Report, which is a broad, it's the largest survey of sort of male sexuality at that point. And it discovers that something on the order of 10% of the adult population reports being, you know, exclusively homosexual for a period of 3 years or more. And that just shocks the country because then it could be, you know, not only are these people invisible, but now it's one out of every 10. And it just, it leads to a sex panic. And it gets conflated with communism, and it transforms from being just a sin or a medical diagnosis into a national security threat.
You say in the book that over time that gay people in Washington would develop their own codes of behavior, they had their own gathering places, their own vernacular is how you put it. What was this kind of vernacular that they had to create? I don't want to overgeneralize here, but I did hear you recently talking with Andrew Sullivan about all of this, and he asked you if there was a type, you know? So it did make me wonder, what was the draw of Washington for gays and lesbians?
I think in the 1930s, it was basically the same draw. That's where I would say where it began. And I don't think it was necessarily particular to Washington, as it was the case for any gay person wanting to move to a city. And that's really the story of gay people in the 20th century is, you know, leaving small towns where they are, you know, it's very easy to be observed by your family, by your friends. You know how small towns can be, right? People talk. And if you have a secret that you need to keep, then you would rather go to a place where you can be more anonymous. You can escape the prying eyes of small town life. And so you see gay people, you know, successive waves are, you know, moving to cities. You know, in Washington, it's really with the rise of the New Deal and the federal government. And we have, you know, I don't have, you know, statistics about this, but from anecdotal evidence, I found and other historians have found that gay people start moving to Washington in that period. They can get a job in the government and sort of avoid the small town prejudices, perhaps. And gay life, there is a sort of very, again, subterranean gay life. Gay men are meeting in Lafayette Square directly across the White House. That's a major cruising ground. But then I think there's a particular type that Washington of gay person who really thrived in Washington. And it's this sort of the author Andy Tobias has come up with the term the best little boy in the world syndrome, yeah. Which is, you know, gay men or who as young men are sort of channeling all their energies and you know, energies that would be going into chasing girls and dating women, right? They're channeling that into schoolwork, into extracurricular activities, trying to be the best they can be, and to overachieve and to be perfectionists, because they feel a sense of vulnerability because of their secret, right? And if they're just, you know, if they can be better than any other of their classmates, then perhaps they won't get suspected, or they won't get beaten up by the bully, right? And that is a certain type that has always sort of thrived in Washington.
You mentioned one of them, Offie.
Carmel Offie.
Carmel Offie, yeah. Who said realized the secret to success was be indispensable.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a young State Department Foreign Service officer who then became one of the early members of the CIA. And he works for William Bullitt, who's the first ambassador to the Soviet Union. And Offie comes from a very, you know, modest background. He's the son of Italian immigrants, which makes him very rare in the Foreign Service at that time. The Foreign Service is, you know, in the State Department is almost exclusively the preserve of, you know, wealthy aristocratic men who go to Yale, Harvard, Princeton, schools like that, who have a private income. That is what the Foreign Service really was in this country until, you know, relatively recently, you know, maybe 50 or 60 years ago. And so he works for William Bullitt, and he's actually quite open, for his time, you could say he was quite openly gay. He did not deny it. This was not a big secret. And he's able to work, you know, for an ambassador, William Bullitt, who then goes on to become ambassador to France. And it's kind of an open secret that he's gay. And I think it's a combination of just kind of his moxie and his unapologetic nature that he was able to kind of get away with it for so long. And it's not until until 1950, right? Until the early years of the Cold War, when homosexuality becomes this national security threat and becomes a weapon in the bureaucratic struggle between the FBI and the CIA, and really within bureaucratic Washington, that he's then sacrificed.
It seems like that is one of the main themes in the book. This important point that you make. You say in the first four decades of the 20th century, homosexuality was not considered to be a threat to American society, but that changes, and we'll dig into that as we go. But before that, and this is how you put it in the book, that this notion of a homosexual person as opposed to homosexual acts was not really widely understood until the late 19th century. So it wasn't thinkable that these people might be, you know, a distinct identity group.
Right. What adds to that is the fact that gay people can hide. You know, unlike African Americans who are identifiable, and therefore it makes political organizing much easier, right? When you can see your group that's being oppressed and make a case to them. Gay people had this thing called the closet. And it was a double-edged sword because you could hide within the closet and you could succeed. You know, you could live, you could pretend that you were something you were not and you could advance and you could get power and money and riches and all those things. Mm. And that's harmful in the sense that it then becomes a challenge to convince those people, come out of your closet, because we need to organize politically to stop this discrimination. And so the closet the closet is really what the book is about, I think, and sort of the challenges presented by the closet. And it's not until gay people start coming out of the closet that they're able to then fight back against the discrimination, against the attacks on them. As long as they're hiding in the closet and there are no visible gay people in society, then you can believe the craziest, wildest, most negative, awful things about them.
Mm. Just trying to imagine what it was like before people felt safe to come out. Of course, you mentioned the scene in Washington, colored handkerchiefs, these sort of coded arrangements. You mentioned how gay men played the role of walkers, you know, escorting the wives of powerful men to parties. No official gatherings were permitted. So, you know, where did they meet? What was the scene like?
Yeah, so the earliest sorts of gay social scene in Washington was Lafayette Square. And there are reports from the late 19th century of the police, you know, making arrests of men meeting one another in Lafayette Square for sexual assignations. And then gay bars, or, you know, not maybe officially, but you know, bars that would cater to a gay clientele. We start seeing reports of those, you know, as early as the 1930s and 40s. Then after the war, they become more numerous. Probably the most famous one was the Chicken Hut right near Lafayette Square, which had a restaurant on the first floor and a bar on the second floor, and sort of widely understood that the bar on the second floor was for gay people. And then there were sort of private parties people would have in their homes. But, you know, DuPont Circle, which is sort of famously known as a gay neighborhood, or as a gayborhood, as we might call it, that doesn't really develop until the 1960s.
So when does this change? As you say, it's the war, the bright post-war, this culture of secrecy starts to descend over the Capitol. And what is once seen as a private vice, this becomes now this public obsession. And at that point, this specter of homosexuality, as you put it, it haunts Washington. And this is where it's so interesting how you describe how homosexuality, even though this is a myth, but it's linked to Nazism. It's linked to communism.
Yeah.
Not to mention the decline and fall of ancient Rome and Greece and the Cuban Revolution and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Just these connections start to be made.
Yeah, I think it just shows you this is how homosexuality was regarded by our society, that it would be associated with any negative development or phenomena. And I just go through the list. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier, William Bullitt, the ambassador to the Soviet Union, he co-wrote a book with Sigmund Freud, the great father of psychoanalysis. They wrote a psychobiography of Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, whom each of them detested for different reasons. Bullitt, because Bullitt had opposed the Versailles Treaty. He had been a young diplomat in the Roosevelt in the Wilson administration, but then came out against the Versailles Treaty and sort of had a very bitter falling out with Wilson. And then Freud detested Wilson for the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire after World War I. And so the two of them write this book where they basically allege that Wilson was a latent homosexual who had an Oedipus complex. And so they essentially, you know, put the blame for the rise of the Nazis, right? For the failure of the Versailles Treaty and the post-war European settlement, they kind of put on the shoulders of Wilson's latent homosexuality. And then during World War II, I mean, I came across numerous government documents, memoranda, in which there's a serious speculation and analysis of the Nazis as being basically a gay cabal. And so this is sort of commonly believed to be the case, that the Nazis are not only sexually degenerate, but sexually degenerate in a homosexual way. And then during the early years of the Cold War. There's this association made between homosexuality and communism, and the notion of the Homintern, the Homosexual International, which is a play on the Comintern, the Communist International, and this belief that homosexuals are not loyal to the country in which they live or the government that they serve. They are loyal to this international fraternity, this international secret brotherhood, and that their loyalties transcend national boundaries.
You know what's remarkable about this connection, the way you describe it, and you know, everyone, most remember February 1950, McCarthy gives the speech to, you know, the Republican ladies in West Virginia, and he talks about this vast communist conspiracy. But you write about the fact that just a few weeks later, there's an even more shocking revelation that 91 gay people have been fired from working in the State Department. Mm-hmm. And that causes far more consternation than the idea of communists. But say a little bit about that.
On February 9th, 1950, Joe McCarthy gives his infamous speech where he declares that he has a list of 205 communists working in the State Department. And then just 3 weeks later, Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, is summoned to the Senate to answer these charges. And he brings along with him a deputy named John Puerfoy, who just in passing, he's discussing people who've been separated from the State Department for various reasons. And says that 91 have been fired over the past 3 years for homosexuality. And this becomes the moment, really, when the Lavender Scare begins. We're all very familiar with the Red Scare. It's taught in schools, and there's been movies and a very famous play by Arthur Miller, the Crucible. We all know about that, but we don't. Yeah. We're not taught about the Lavender Scare, which I would say is worse in the sense that, you know, unlike the Red Scare, which was based on a real, genuine, and legitimate fear of communism, and there were actually high-ranking communists in the State Department, there was no basis whatsoever for the Lavender Scare. I mean, there's not a single example of, in the history of the United States, of a gay person giving over secret information because he was blackmailed. The Defense Department actually did a study of this in the early 1990s, and they found that there was not a single example. So it was completely without basis. It was a complete and utter moral panic, but it was one in which, you know, there was very little dissent offered. And, you know, there were people on the other side of the Red Scare. You know, Joe McCarthy had critics. And there were people willing to stand up to him. It took them a while, but they did. And there were, you know, people like Joe Alsop, as I mentioned earlier. There was really no one defending gay people in the Lavender Scare. Not even the ACLU would defend gay people. And you know, I write about the first person to challenge his firing was a man named Frank Kameny. He was a PhD astronomer from Harvard who was working for the Army Map Service in 1957, just a couple months after the launch of Sputnik. And he was fired for being gay, and he became the first person to challenge it and to essentially come out of the closet and say, "I am a homosexual, and in no way does this impede my ability to serve my country." And he sues the government. He's unsuccessful, but he wages a, you know, decades long campaign for gay equality that is victorious. I mean, you know, the ideas and the goals that Frank Kameny tried to achieve were achieved, not necessarily in his lifetime. He died in 2011, but he did live to see some incredible changes.
Frank Kameny is an important figure, sounds like, not just in the book, but in your life. You knew him quite well, and it seems like he had some influence on you wanting to tell the story in some way.
Yes, I got to know Frank when I was actually in college. I had email correspondence with him, and then I got to know him when I moved to Washington, D.C. And I interviewed him for the book, and I witnessed a very moving ceremony in the year 2009, early in the Obama administration, when the Office of Personnel Management, which was the successor agency to the Civil Service Commission, which was the agency that was responsible for carrying out these investigations and firings of gay people. They issued a formal apology to Frank, and it was the director of OPM, John Barry, who happened to be a gay man himself, and First Lady Michelle Obama was there as well. And it was a very moving ceremony, and it sort of struck me that there were clearly many other people like Frank who had been fired, whose stories, you know, who didn't go public and whose stories would otherwise remain unknown, you know, had not I started this research and written this book. And there were also lots of people who kept their secret and stayed in government, who stayed in the closet. And that also seemed to me like a very interesting story that needed to be told.
Mm. I was struck by the life that Frank Kameny led. I mean, you've talked about the fact that he basically was penniless for years because of all of this.
Yes, and you have to understand, if you were declared a homosexual, that means you could not get a job with any federal contractor, you know. And so Frank had a PhD. This was during the Cold War. I mean, his skills should have been in very high demand. But you know, I went through his papers, and you just see all these rejection letters from various laboratories and, you know, scientific concerns. All these places would not hire him, and he lived a very frugal, is a nice way of putting it, a very frugal existence for many. For really his entire life, it was a life in penury, and he did it with a real stoicism. I mean, he never complained about not having money. That was not the issue for him. He wanted to right a wrong, and he was extremely stubborn, and oftentimes stubbornness is a poor quality that we don't like in people. But in this case, I think it was extremely, extremely important. We should all be grateful that he was such a stubborn person.
Jamie Kirchick, he's a columnist for Tablet magazine. His new book is Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Remember the last time that you started a sentence with I heard on KUER? Well, that story was made possible because listeners just like you contribute to this station. But it's not just direct donations of dollars. You can also help by donating a vehicle you no longer use. KUER accepts cars, trucks, motorcycles, SUVs, RVs, and yes, even boats. The process is simple. Learn more and start the process of your donation today by visiting KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Jamie Kirchick is with us talking about his new book, which reveals the wide-ranging influence of gay men and lesbians on the nation's capital. The book is called Secret City. He describes it as a new interpretation of the country's past, exploring the evolution of American politics and government by telling the stories of people who were forced to keep a core part of themselves hidden. We should talk about J. Edgar Hoover. And one of the things you point out, and you're quite careful about this, there's no actual evidence that Hoover was gay.
Nope.
But you do write about just – maybe say something about just how much effort the FBI puts into quelling these rumors about Hoover's sexuality over the years. There's one story you mentioned from 1943. This woman – I think she happens to just spread this rumor somewhere, and it talk about this, because this is extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, she's at a bridge party in rural Pennsylvania or Ohio, I'm forgetting exactly where. And, you know, she says that the FBI director is a queer. And it just so happens that one of the other ladies at this party, her nephew, is a agent in the FBI, and she mentions it to him, and he kicks it up the ladder, and it makes its way to Washington, and soon this woman is called into the FBI field office, where the special agent in charge gives her a very stern talking to, demanding to know where she heard this rumor, why she would be spreading such lies about a patriotic American like J. Edgar Hoover in a time of war, and orders her to go back and tell all the women in her bridge club that she was mistaken. She don't know what came over her. And she wants to disabuse them of the notion that the FBI director is queer. And there are just multiple examples of this, of, you know, private citizens having what they believe are private conversations. And somehow the word of this gets to the FBI and they get knocks on the door. They're basically intimidated into divulging where they heard it or recanting it. It's sort of like a police state, frankly.
Let's talk about John F. Kennedy. I'm not sure if people know what his best friend, was gay. Where do you sort of situate Kennedy or the Kennedys anyway of that era and the secret part of the city?
Well, the Kennedys, I think, are the first couple really to sort of welcome gay men into their social circles. Hmm. And you know, Jack Kennedy's best friend. From Choate, from the very upper, the very sort of Tony private boarding school that he went to, was Lem Billings, who came out to him when they were both teenagers. And they remained lifelong best friends. And Lem had a room in the White House when JFK was serving as president. Also, Gore Vidal, the famous writer who was related to Jackie by marriage. When he campaigned for Congress in 1960, JFK was right there with him, campaigning alongside him. William Walton, the arts advisor, a very important role in the Kennedy White House, and the aforementioned Joe Alsop, who again was not open about it, but certainly Kennedy knew. He was aware, as president, we can assume he was aware of Joe's great folly in Moscow. In Jackie, you know, her famous pillbox hat was designed by Halston, the designer, and she was also great friends with Truman Capote. So they, in a sort of social way, sort of welcomed gay men into their coterie, into their court of Camelot. But the policies of the United States government under Jack Kennedy, you know, in no way was there a relenting in the purge of gay people from government jobs.
And this comes a little bit later as LBJ becomes president. But I have to say, it's not a terribly flattering portrait of Bill Moyers.
No, it's not. Bill Moyers is involved, actually, in the firing of Bob Waldron, who I mentioned earlier. He was also sort of tasked with trying to dig up dirt on whether or not there were homosexuals on Barry Goldwater's staff. And, you know, one of the things I learned in writing this book is that often, you know, the most pious people really have little to be pious about. And I think Bill Moyers is an example of that. I mean, this is a man who's had a career for decades as basically being, you know, Mr. Piety in chief. And his record when he was working for LBJ was, you know, not something to be particularly proud of, particularly when it came to gay people on staff. He was extremely Machiavellian and quite vicious in the actions he undertook with regard to suspected homosexuals in Washington.
You say no president was more obsessed with this so-called gay menace than Richard Nixon. Talk about the Nixon administration. What was the secret city like in those days?
Well, I open up with this really wild story involving a man named Murray Chotiner, who was basically the guy who gave Richard Nixon the nickname Tricky Dick. Basically is attributable to Murray Chotiner. He had been working with Nixon since he ran for Congress in the late 1940s. And he did not get a job in the Nixon White House and was quite resentful and angry about this. So he plants a rumor with the newspaper columnist Jack Anderson that Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, and Dwight Chapin, these three Nixon aides, he alleges that the three of them are involved in a menage a trois, and they're meeting every morning at the Watergate Hotel. And Anderson brings this to the FBI. The FBI brings it to John Mitchell, the Attorney General, and they basically launch a kind of internal White House witch hunt. And the three Nixon aides are called in to the Cabinet Room, where J. Edgar Hoover and Mark Felt, the deputy director, are administering lie detector tests to get them to confess or deny whether or not they're homosexuals. So the Nixon administration sort of opens with this you know, fear. And then in retaliation, Nixon tries to smear Jack Anderson as a homosexual just 2 years later, when Anderson is publishing, he gets a leak from something on the National Security Council, and Nixon is convinced that the person who leaked it to him was his gay lover. And he's determined to find evidence for this. He gets the plumbers involved. And then you can just listen on the tapes. I think some of the most amusing moments in this book are just the transcripts of Nixon's conversations with his aides, where he's just talking at length about homosexuality. And this is when I refer to, you know, the attribution of the downfalls of Rome and Greece. That comes out of Nixon's mouth.
With Kissinger, I think.
Right? Yes, it's quite amusing. And then he's saying that the Soviets are spreading homosexuality because they know it leads to the downfall of civilization. He's speculating that various journalists are gay. Not all of them necessarily enemies. He says, you know, Alan Drury, the novelist, and Joe Alsop, he says that they're both homosexuals. Some of our best friends are, but so are some of our worst enemies. And he names Joseph Kraft, who was a columnist for the Washington Post, and who there was no evidence that Joe Kraft was gay. I don't know where Nixon got this. But yeah, it's definitely something that's sort of on his mind, or that he seems to have sort of thoughts. He seems to have sort of developed theories and thoughts about homosexuality to an extent that his predecessors and his successors didn't really dwell on the subject. It was something that they were certainly, you know, they opposed it. They didn't want gays in government, but they weren't obsessed to it to this degree that Nixon was.
Jamie Kirchick, his book is Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER keeps you company with storytelling and vital information. No matter where you are, KUER helps you stay engaged, informed, and, well, smart. Speaking of, did you know your smart speaker can keep you connected to NPR and KUER news and entertainment? Never miss another story or episode of your favorite program. Just tell your device to play KUER. Learn more about how to listen with your smart speaker by visiting KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer and journalist Jamie Kirchick. His new book is about the hidden history of gay people in Washington during the 20th century. And he explains how people who were interested in politics and public policy, how they survived during this decades-long period where they had to be vigilant and secretive. He explores the choices and sacrifices they had to make. The book is called Secret City. I have to say, it seems like one of the most explosive stories, it's a story that you break in the book, is about how the 1980 presidential campaign of Ronald Reagan is almost sidetracked by these accusations that he's being directed by this group of right-wing homosexual advisors. Take us through that story. This is fascinating.
So it really dates back to 1967 when Ronald Reagan was governor, and Drew Pearson, who was a muckraking newspaper columnist, he publishes a column that fall in which he alleges that a group of Reagan aides had a gay orgy at a home in Lake Tahoe, at a timeshare in Lake Tahoe. And Reagan so furiously denies that he had fired. The allegations is that he fired two aides who were involved in it. And Reagan at first furiously denies this. And he does so for the right reasons. He doesn't want to bring sort of, you know, shame or dishonor upon the men and their families. But 2 weeks later, he's forced to admit that he did actually fire the men. It's actually unclear this day whether or not there had ever been this homosexual orgy. It's probably much more likely that the allegations of it were being used in sort of a inter-office bureaucratic, you know, turf battle, which is something that often happens, we see in the book, where allegations of homosexuality are just used as a weapon, often with no basis whatsoever, because they are, because it is this terrible, it is the most powerful, you know, weapon in politics, is this accusation of homosexuality. But that really, you know, sticks with Reagan. People don't forget it. And in 1980, there's a group of moderate to liberal Republicans who are not happy with the, you know, takeover of the party, or the ascendance of the conservative wing as embodied by Ronald Reagan. And they bring a basically, one of them, Pete McCloskey, who was a sort of legendary figure in Republican politics. He was the first Republican to run for Congress against the Vietnam War. He was a Marine veteran. He was a Marine veteran of the Korean War, and he was very anti-war in Vietnam. And he mounted a primary challenge to Richard Nixon in 1972 from the left on an anti-war platform. And, you know, also came from California, from the Bay Area, and just was on the complete opposite side of the party as Ronald Reagan. And they never had a good relationship. And he wanted to really torpedo his chances. And he comes into possession of, you know, two other men who come to him with allegations that there is a network of gay men still surrounding Ronald Reagan, that, you know, he wasn't able to flush them out in 1967, that there's something suspicious and shady going on. And he brings, he basically types up a 13-page memo, which I discovered. And he brings it to Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post. He basically knocks on his door, like in the middle of the night, and just kind of gives him this dossier. And, you know, Bradley takes it seriously. I mean, he assembles his best reporters the next day, and they go off and fan out across the country to investigate. And they do come up with evidence that there are a number of gay men working for Ronald Reagan, but the notion that they are sort of involved in kind of some kind of conspiratorial malign, you know, agenda, there's no evidence for that. And they don't publish the story. And I discovered the story. I discovered the records of it in Ben Bradley's papers. So, you know, McCloskey's memo and all the reporters' memos, all their, you know, interview transcripts and whatnot. And I reconstruct it in the book. And I do so because I think, you know, even if the story itself wasn't newsworthy in 1980, and I agree with Ben Bradley's judgment that there was not something that needed to be published, I think now, 42 years later, it's important for us to understand, well, this is what people were saying. Well, this is what was going on behind the scenes. There was a real genuine fear from some very serious people in the Republican Party that Ronald Reagan was being manipulated by a gay cabal, and the Washington Post investigated it. I think that's newsworthy, and it gives us a window into how this issue of homosexuality was viewed in 1980.
So toward the end of the book, you mentioned how the story of Secret City is also the story of the country, you know, in some ways overcoming this really deep fear. But I also wanted to bring up something you write about the present. It's not part of this book, but late last month you wrote this piece for the New York Magazine where you explore the motives behind this effort going on right now in these Republican-controlled state legislatures, you know, to limit the discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity. And you write about how these bills show that this fear of homosexuality, I guess how it's evolved and how it continues to play a role in American politics and society. Say something about that. This seems like something you're thinking a lot about.
One thing I realized writing this book is that there's a very conspiratorial element to homophobia. Mm. We're all familiar with the Judeo-Christian religious opposition to homosexuality, which is probably the prevailing one. There's also been, I think, just a certain level of disgust that some people have with gay sexual practices, what used to be referred to as the ick factor. And that, I think, also has played a role in sort of bigotry against gay people and gay men in particular. But there's this other element that's different from other types of bigotry, although it's quite similar to anti-Semitism, which is also a there's a very conspiratorial element of anti-Semitism, right? And sort of seeing people operating in secret. They're operating in shadows. They are up to malign activities. And this is an element of homophobia that I really date back to the early 20th century. And there's a political element to this. When it's really the first gay scandal of the modern era, I guess you could say, when the Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany was accused of being manipulated by a gay cabal, just as, you know, 80 years later in a different country, Ronald Reagan was also accused of being manipulated in a gay cabal. It's just very similar. It's very remarkable, the kind of echoes of this and the allegations that it was this, you know, group of men who were not loyal to Germany. They were not loyal to the empire. They had loyalties to other sexual deviants in other countries. They were cosmopolitan, you know, globalist is the word that we might use today. And this just becomes a recurring pattern. And it has to do with the secret elements. And as long as gay people were living in secret, that then means that they, you know, why are they secret? Why are they hiding? What's going on? They must be hiding something bad. And also the sense that they're everywhere, right? That gays are, they're rich gays, they're poor gays, they're right-wing gays, they're left-wing gays, they're black, they're white, they're Jews, they're Muslim, they're Christian, they're all over the world, they're in every community. And it is therefore they're loyal to one another. They're not loyal to their, you know, to their homeland. And this is also a very conspiratorial, element of it. And yeah, I just think that it seems to be echoing today in some of the rhetoric that we hear in some of these legislatures.
So this homin turn is now turned into the homosexual agenda. It's just a new twist on that idea.
Right. Right.
You mentioned early in the book, Jamie, that writing all of this revealed what you describe as these once invisible stories and relationships to this city that you thought you knew so much. You've been there a long time. I'm wondering, I guess, how did exploring all of these stories, how did it change the way you've come to see the place? And even some of these actual places that you mentioned that you go by now all of the time. How did it change what you see in that city?
That's a good question. Well, it gave me a lot more respect for the Hay Adams Hotel, I guess. I just always saw it as a fancy, you know, just sort of a fancy elite hotel. I never knew it had this great civil rights history behind it. I came away with, you know, writing this book, just feeling an enormous sense of gratitude. Understanding how hard it was for people, trying to imagine how hard it was for people like me to operate in a town like Washington, just really puts things into perspective and just makes you very grateful to live in a country where these sorts of things don't happen anymore. We don't oppress gay people like this. We don't make homosexuality a sort of condition for your being fired, or, you know, opportunities are not denied to people because they're gay anymore. At least I've never had that obstacle. And I think it's just a real tribute to the people who came before, people like Frank Kameny, who I mentioned, and many others who just had the courage to realize that it was society that was wrong, not them.
Let me just ask you finally, you mentioned in the book that you're hoping to offer this new interpretation of the past. Right now we think about gay history as a separate and distinct. You're trying to just sort of weave these threads together. You say it's your overriding ambition. Just maybe say something about that finally. Do you feel like you're getting there, I guess?
Yes, absolutely. I think that a problem with gay history is that it's been sort of sequestered and seen as, you know, gay history and just seen as a separate section of the bookshelf at the bookstore. And I really was writing this book for everyone. It was not written for a specialized academic audience. It was written for all Americans, gay and straight, to understand that gay people have always had a role in our society. There are stories of, you know, courage. There are stories of cowardice. There are stories of oppression. There are stories of triumph. And I hope readers will be enriched by it.
Jamie Kirchick, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jamie Kirchick, his book is called Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, David Childs, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.